This is Matt Freitas, and you're listening to the Late Night History Podcast. This week, we have a special two-part episode featuring retired Marine Colonel and Navy Cross recipient Eddie Ray. The majority of our discussion in Part 1 covers Eddie's life story leading up to the Gulf War, which includes his childhood upbringing in L.A., playing college football at the University of Washington alongside future NFL Hall of Fame QB Warren Moon, and highlights from Eddie's early career as an enlisted Marine and junior officer. The episode is packed with a lot of interesting history and lessons learned. Notably, he assumed command of the Marines Light Armored Vehicles Company. The assignment was considered the kiss of death because nobody understood how to operate with the unproven LAVs. Of course, that reputation would change under Eddie, where he combined football-inspired plays with military tactics for the battlefield. But you'll hear all about that in Part 2. Now let's get to the episode with retired Marine Colonel Eddie Ray. So I'm sitting here tonight, because it's Late Night History, with your host, Matt Freitas, me. Welcome to the show, Eddie.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And for the listeners who don't know, we've been talking about football, because that's some of our passion. But before we go into football, can you tell me a little bit about your childhood, like where you grew up?
Yeah, I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, kind of between for people that don't know, it's kind of between the far south end of the Los Angeles city limits and then what became LA County, a small area called now it's called Athens. Athens is just south of the city before you get to San Pedro. That's sort of in the tweener area. Matter of fact, it was across the street was a dairy farm when I was growing up there. Huge dairy farm. All that's paved over in buildings now, but that's the way it was.
And it is there anything like historically interesting about your hometown?
Other than being Los Angeles, the city went through a big transition growing up when I went through between Los Angeles and Orange County was literally orange groves. There was nothing between where I lived and Disneyland, really, at the time. And now I grew up during the time that I start seeing the changes happen. It became the area that I lived in was really a quiet area. It evolved to a very dangerous area, became a lot of gangs started developing and that sort of thing. And it just went from a kind of almost a semi-rural, it wasn't really rural, but it was kind of semi-rural, to a place that became dangerous, became difficult to live in. But most of the ones in my generation, we kind of saw the transition happen right in front of our eyes. So that was...
What time frame?
Well, put it this way, I was born in 1954, and that's a couple days before you were born, but during the time, so I was in school from, I don't know, I guess through the 60s and 70s, so it was during that time frame, so we had the, period of time when I was younger, Watts riots went down there That was pretty, that was a phenomenon. That was very strange because pretty much the entire city, at least that part of the city was, under a martial law. I didn't know what that was. I just knew that we couldn't leave home. Just kind of sat and waited to for things to settle down. So it was pretty, in some respects, in retrospect, I guess it was pretty traumatic, but strange how when you live in a certain environment and it evolves right in front of you, you're comfortable with it. You can just, you just kind of learn to survive in that situation. And so that's kind of the way it was. Never left until I went away to University of Washington. That's when I actually left the city turned out to be for good. I didn't plan for it to be that way, but that's the way it turned out. And once I got to Seattle, the realization hit me that that the stress, the worry about, the worry about being a crime victim or having to make sure you're traveling in a certain neighborhood that, you weren't going to get victimized, that sort of thing. All of a sudden, I got to a city where I didn't have to worry about that, which was interesting. And it was enlightening because it helped me mirror. I started realizing that I didn't have to live like that. I didn't have to deal with it. I could live someplace that was more peaceful and safe. And I could recognize the difference. And
Can you tell me a little
irony.
bit about your parents?
My mother got killed in a traffic accident when I was 14. So I spent most of my teenage years on with my father alone. But before that, my mother was a housekeeper, and my father drove a trash truck in Los Angeles. And so that's how the income was made for my family. And we just grew up I grew up in a situation where integrity was a big thing. My parents believed that honesty was always the best policy. Don't take anything that's not yours. Just because nobody's watching you doesn't mean you shouldn't do the right thing. Those are the values that I grew up with. And when my mother passed away, that was about the most traumatic thing that ever could have happened to me, especially at the time. But I didn't realize until many years later how traumatic it was. And it had an effect on me. It just made me live. I kind of lived with what I would guess to be, I didn't worry about I didn't worry about much. I just kind of, hey, I never wanted to look back. So I just kind of kept everything I did was forward looking. I started thinking that way. And I didn't, probably because when I look back, I remember who she was. And I prefer not to, and I prefer not to think about that because it was pretty traumatic to me. It affected me in a lot of ways.
And how were you as a student and then as an athlete? What kind of sports did you play? Things like that.
I played football. That was the only sport I actually played, and that at least in intercollegiately. And as a student, it was kind of It's funny, interesting you'd ask that question because I was an average student. I went through a period where I felt like I was struggling. I was putting so much time in to study, and the more time I put in studying, it seems like the less I was getting out of it. And one day I went to a I actually joined the Marine Corps. Left school, joined the Marine Corps because I had actually gotten hurt, but gotten them, and I wanted to finish my degree, and I took a class at night, and I put a lot of time into it, and I got no better grades than I did before, and so I went to I just happened to go to a library, and I was thinking, I'm going to prepare myself for the next class. While I was in the library, I thought, gee whiz, I really got to make better grades. Whatever I could do to get better grades, I need to do. So I'm gonna get the book. I was gonna take a chemistry class. I'm gonna get a chemistry book and study it, before I even take the class. And in the old days, we had these card catalogs in the library. I don't know if you're old enough to even know. Well, I'm sure you've heard of the card
I heard
catalog.
of him,
Yeah, but anyway, I looked, and for some reason, I was thinking how to make better grades. I need to know how to make better grades, and I found a book. In the card, I saw a card just looking up grades. And I'm leafing through the cards, and there's a book called How to Make Better Grades. And I said, oh my goodness. So I copied the location, went through the stacks, found the book. It was there. It was about maybe 200 pages at the most, paperback, matter of fact. And I started reading it in the, standing there reading it. And I, started with the introduction, everything, just, and the author was talking to me literally the way as I was reading it. It's like, do you find yourself putting in all these hours studying and you're not getting anything out of it? And I'm thinking as I'm reading it, it's like, my goodness, that's me. It changed my life because it gave me the tools that I didn't have, the study skills, where to, how to study, when the, certain types of classes, what how to prepare yourself, making sure you're in a quiet space to study, studying in smaller increments, 30 minutes to an hour at a time, then rest and then go back, that sort of stuff. How to do your notes, how to prepare for a class, take 15 minutes to 30 minutes before your class just to go over things before you walk into the class. It was something that I could do because, first off, having the tools, the techniques, and leveraging techniques was what I learned to do playing sports. And I learned how to do that in academics. And of course, everything changed. Everything changed from that point on. I was a, it, you know, after that I learned to expect nothing but A's. That was it, the best. And that was my expectation at that point because I knew what I was doing. And it was sort of kind of a laugh because I thought to myself, gee whiz, if I had known this,
Yeah.
beforehand, what direction would I have taken? Nah, I don't know. But
Yeah, but
that's not how it worked.
that's also pretty cool, like how that kind of shifted your life, how that you use that as like as a lesson of preparation, which I think is pretty cool.
Well, I tell you what, it's one of the things that story, I've told that story, I don't know, dozens of times for sure. But one of the things that I did, and I made it my business in the Marine Corps, is to tell that story. To when I was in command, anytime I was in command, and my especially my crew, when I was in Desert Storm, guys on my vehicle, they had to deal with me pretty much reiterating the whole thing enough times to where now every one of them left, graduated from college, and to me, I'm really, they've done some wonderful things, and I like to think that I had an influence in that, and because I think the first thing that I tell them is, hey, you're smart enough to, you're smart enough to do what I did, except you're probably a lot smarter than I am. The only difference is this. Then I talk to them about the study skills, how to do it, and where to get the information. I don't get into the how-to very much. I let them learn it on their own. I just try to tell them where to find the information they need. I'm really, really proud of that. That's probably the most important thing that I feel like I've done in the years that I've been in the Marine Corps.
Wow. That's awesome. And I also wanted to just jump back a little bit to were you recruited to go to University of Washington, or did you, how did you what was that progression from high school to college?
That's interesting. I played high school football, and I played on a team, and we lost every game one year, then we won one game the next year, and that sort of thing. We were just lousy as a team. And so, but I really wanted to play. I thought I might be pretty good. But I was an offensive lineman, and colleges, nobody really scouts losing teams. That's not a word. And so
True.
I went to a junior college called Los Angeles City College, and they had a football program, so I decided to go there. And in doing, I went there, and a guy by the name of Vince Evans showed up from North Carolina. He ended up played in the NFL. He was a quarterback. And then we had another guy who showed up there, got a guy by the name of Rod Martin, who ended up playing for his entire career. He played with the Raiders. And those are the two most noteworthy guys. But we had several that were really good. And we had a coach who was the first, he was the first experience I had with what I call a real leader. He knew how to motivate people and get people focused on the team and not themselves. And we went on to win a championship. We went undefeated. And then all of a sudden, all these colleges were recruiting me. And it's interesting because at the time, if back then, if you were interested in a school, of course they'd come and visit you, but they generally sent you a letter first to see if you were interested. And you just basically fill it in and put the letter back in the self-addressed envelope, a return address envelope, and send it back to them, so they know you were interested. I got a letter from a place with it had this brown envelope. Literally, it was like a It was it's a place I'd never even heard of. It was Brown University. And being from Los Angeles, it's like, what in the world? Who the heck is this? Because all I'm looking at are, the Division I schools, and that's it. And of course, my background, where I grew up, nobody knew Brown University. The irony is, about 30 years later, I'm in Newport, Rhode Island, and there's Brown University. I said, oh my God. Oh my God. But that's how it went. I was recruited by, it got so bad. I used to take trips that year. I would take a trip to one school, fly back, and then it got so tiresome until I would take a trip. The schools would pay for me to leave one school, and I just fly directly to another school. And then, rather than to go all the way back home and come, go back to the airport, that sort of thing. So it was a fun year after that for a few months. And I tried to take every trip I could, really.
What other schools were there?
Oh geez. Well, most of the back then it was a pack. It was actually the Pac-8. I think before they broke up, they were the Pac-12. But all the all the schools on the West Coast. And the only thing is, I wanted to leave town. I didn't anything that was outside of that pack. I didn't even entertain, except the University of Hawaii, only because my coach said, take the trip. Just take, because I had so many contacts, and I was only interested in playing on the West Coast. That's all I knew. I was recruited by all the schools in the at the time. But I definitely, two things I wanted to do is I wanted to not stay in Los Angeles, and I wanted to stay on the West Coast. I was not only school I wasn't recruited from is was Stanford. Cal, yes, or whatever, for Stanford was not on my list. I'm not sure. I don't know if academically they didn't think I was to their standard. I don't know, but it was really a non-issue because my first choice was originally Cal, and I went there, stayed there about a month before school started, and it was just it's too much like Los Angeles for me. And so I went to Washington instead. So Seattle was more sublime for my temperament. So it was good.
And Washington is also known for snowing. What was experience you had there?
Oh yeah. My first year there, it eventually snowed, and of course I called home. We lived in the dorms, and so the and cell phones were not a thing at that time. And so my first experience with snow, about a couple of inches of snow landed, which for somebody in Massachusetts is like that's not even,
It's like a
that's not
Tuesday.
even. Yeah, it's like, man, that's sweatshirt weather for you. It's like, you don't even bother putting a coat on. But anyway, I get out there, and I'm like, and I'm traumatized. I'm from Southern California. I called home, to tell my father, that there's snow and it's like cold. And I had to call him long distance, collect. And he expected, I guess he figured it was an emergency or something. And I started telling him about the weather and how cold it was, and I needed to come back home. And he just, yeah, I must have really set him off because he says, hey, he says, you're going to stick it out. And if this is why you're calling me, don't call me anymore. And I said, and he hung up the phone. It was like I was, oh my goodness. I'm in a literally in a phone booth. And I got out of phone booth, start walking back to the dorm, and I start thinking, gee whiz, if I slipped on a piece of ice and banged my head, passed out, and then a big snowdrift fell over me, and then I just froze to death, and nobody found me till spring, it would serve him right. I just concocted some crazy thing in my head, and it's like, but none of that happened. It's barely enough snow on the ground to cover my feet, much less for me to get covered. Good anyway, and in retrospect, that was probably the best thing that he ever could have done, is to just hey, stick it out, you. And I'm glad he did. And he and I have laughed about that.
Yeah, it's
So
funny because like what you when you're young, what enters your mind of like it's like a ridiculous like thing when you think about it now, or just like what you used to think when you were a kid, but it's just like I would have showed him.
he'd have been he'd be really sorry. He'd be sorry if I turned by. I froze to death in a snowdrift, and he never, they didn't know where I was, and I was just going there.
I remember when we spoke on the phone, I asked if you were salty about the national championship this year because Washington played against Michigan. But what do you can you talk about that as well as your playing days when you're at Washington?
Sure. A couple things. One is I went to Washington and during a transition between a guy by the name of Jim Owens, who was coaching, and another guy by the name of Don James. Don James was a big difference. Another one of those examples of how to have a winning program. And he went from, we were. Washington was mediocre at the time when I got there, but that wasn't why I went. I just went there because it was a better place to live. Get there and Don James showed up, and he was a great player. Matter of fact, I mean, great coach. Warren Moon showed up, great quarterback, ended up being the Hall of Famer, and we just went from like mediocre to great within a year. And so fast forward to this past year when Washington played Michigan, and quite frankly it was nice to see. I think that Michigan, it was a great game. I have no I have no angst against Michigan. They, in a way, I really like to watch Harbaugh and his method, because he's all about winning. That's really all it is. But then that's the other thing I see about the coach from Washington, who is now the coach at Alabama. He's really all about winning. And I thought what was interesting was that it, man for man, I think that Washington did not have the the quality team that Michigan had, but scheme wise, taking advantage of looking for opportunities to take advantage, I think Washington did a great job with that. Coach did a great job with that. And I love watching it. I was disappointed that Huskies didn't win, but hey, it is what it is. It is like that sometimes, you
And
know?
like you went to the national championship, so it means like for the next like probably 5 years, you're set up great for at Washington, you know?
They were set up great,
Oh yeah, that's right.
but the coach left.
Yeah.
It's like, the Alabama, Nick Saban retires in Alabama, had to, it's like they offered him, I'm sure they offered him a whole bunch of money, and then you got that prestige of, Alabama football and all that. It's like, what can you do with it? I mean, I would have liked to have seen the University of Washington just maybe up get in the bidding war to keep him, but they didn't. So what can I do? Hopefully we can make another great coach. Sarkisian used to coach at Washington, and he got poached away. And he's the coach of Texas now. So, anyway, maybe it's a coaching
Like a
coup.
stepping stone.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's what it's turning into. But oh well.
And you mentioned Warren Moon. Did you play with Warren Moon?
Yeah. Yes.
What was that like? He's like, of course, as a fa like a football fan. I mean, he was a played for the Oilers and he was a Hall of Famer. Like, how was he in college?
Oh, I tell you what, when he got there, and I talked to him about this, he was the first quarterback that I've ever played with who could run, run, I'd say pretty much, almost full speed and throw the ball accurately on the run. Not break stride, not do all, not set his feet. He's running. He can throw accurately. And the first time I saw him do it was in practice. I didn't think much of it because I've seen quarterbacks. We had a offense that every now and then the quarterback would have to run and throw the ball. And the quarterbacks I'd seen, they were generally, if a person was accurate running 50% of the time, that was considered pretty good. So I didn't think much of it because I figured the next time he do it, next time he did it was probably going to be not so great. Well, it turned out that every time he ran certain plays where he had to run the ball and throw, he was throwing accurately, as accurate as if he was standing, standing still in the pocket. And somewhere along the way, it dawned on me that this wasn't random. He was actually that good. He was better than I expected anybody to be at the time, because of that whole evolution of a running quarterback, at a person who could throw on the run. It just hadn't, it wasn't that much of an expectation. And in a way, he was revolutionizing the game. And I think a lot of people don't recognize that. But that was pretty unique for its time. And yeah, so he was great. It was really sad that at the time he barely got drafted coming out of college, and he had won a Rose Bowl, just statistically one of the best quarterbacks in the nation, and he got drafted in the I don't know, seventh or eighth round. Back then they had more rounds than what they have now. And so he was drafted so late, he decided to just play in Canada. And so that's where he won several Grey Cups, several Canadian football championships, and then came back into the NFL. Got an opportunity to play in the NFL after, I don't know, six, five, anywhere from 5 to 7 years. I'm not sure exactly how many years he played in Canada, but he played quite a few years in Canada before he came back to the NFL. And in a way, as great as he was in the NFL, you could make the case that some of his best years were in Canada, and people didn't really get a chance to experience that. But that's okay. He made it to the Hall of Fame, so he's okay.
Yeah, for sure. And so you went to Washington, was it 1974 to 76?
Yes, it came in. Yeah, I joined the Marine Corps in 77. Actually, I was there till 77, really, but I joined the Marine Corps in 77.
So I actually looked you up on YouTube, and there's a footage of you versus Washington State in Washington, and I see number 65. Eddie Ray playing against Washington State, I think in 1974. It's like that game is on YouTube.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, it was probably if. I don't know. I'm sure that if you got a if you could the technology, what was it like? Wasn't very clear, I bet,
Was a
to
little
see.
gr it was grainy, but in no sound, but it was cool. It was cool.
But you got to be kidding me. Saw that.
Yeah, it
Wow.
was pretty wild. I was like, wow, I see it, like, and I looked like I was looking up like some like you can look up the 1974 Washington Huskies football team and Eddie Ray, right? Offensive guard or offensive tackle, number 65, and I was
Yeah,
like,
that's right. Not many
starter.
people know that.
Did a
I
little
actually started.
research.
I know. It's like I actually started that year. Actually, I was an honorable mention to all conference team, but it'd probably be harder to even find that because that was you had. At that time, they had a first, second, and then an honorable mention. It's like they, it's like a couple of people that'll give the, he's okay. We'll just mention he gets an honorable mention. But I was pretty proud of the time, honestly, and but as things would happen, I ended up. In next spring practice, I actually tore a muscle running sprints. And as a tore quad, took a while to heal. And I kept trying to play. That was, in retrospect, that was one of those lessons that I learned. I shouldn't have tried to play. I just should have waited until I was fully healed. Because I tried to play, then I hurt myself again, but this time I, kind of pinched a nerve in my neck. Then I had a little shoulder ding, and in retrospect, it was because I was doing odd things to compensate for what I was physically missing at the time, and it's kind of it's in what can happen when you play a sport like that is when you're not ready to come back, you're vulnerable to other injuries because it's rather than being 100%, you're 75%, and just kind of you do things to offset or compensate, and that's what happened to me. And I look back on it. I would have waited, maybe even sat out the entire year and come back. But that is that hindsight thing. It's always 2020, afterward.
And before we go into how you decided to go into the Marines, I just want to so like nowadays you play offensive line at a D1 school and you're probably like 300 pounds, really tall, like 6'7". How tall were you and how much did you weigh at that time?
I was about 6'3", and I was probably about 270, 275-ish at the time, something like that. At the time, I was starting to have trouble just keeping that weight. But my game was more position and technique than actually overpowering somebody anyway. So I was adequate for that time in the evolution of the sport. Right now, that's like, I want to play line at, it's like, oh man, it's like, no, that wouldn't be I wouldn't be suitable for much right now.
Yeah, maybe
Basically.
like a middle linebacker or
That's about it. There's a defensive line, and maybe you can get on the end, which I wasn't fat that fast to play on the defensive end. Definitely not inside, not an inside lineman, and that's what I played. I mean, as a matter of fact, a couple of guys on the line. When you look at that, there was a guy by the name of Ray Penny who played offensive line. He played for the Pittsburgh Steelers for about 15, 10, 15 years. He was a center though then. And then another guy by the name of Blair Bush, who played center. He played for the Bengals for a long time. We had some pretty good players then. And I'm kind of proud to have even played alongside him. Matter of fact, I haven't talked to him. I haven't talked to Ray in a long time, but occasionally we've made contacts, but it's been a while.
That's really cool insight that just how like the caliber of players that you played alongside, like Warren Moon, and then of course the guys on the offensive line, especially they go on and have great careers in the NFL. But it was that path was a little different for you. And did you have any family like military lineage?
Just my father, my father was in World War II. I had an uncle who was in the Air Force during the, I guess it was, kind of post-Korea, that sort of thing. It wasn't, I don't know. It's kind of interesting. It wasn't the family lineage that drew me to the military. I don't know. I was always fascinated by it. And I kind of felt like if I had the opportunity, I would have gone. If not for the sport, I probably would have gone in the military anyway. Because I wanted to leave. I wanted to leave town. I wanted to do something different. How I ended up in the Marine Corps, which is interesting, because for me, I didn't know much about the Marine Corps. I didn't know much about ranks or any of that. I just knew it was kind of, something that I wanted to do. And so I ended up going to a recruiter after I had a neck injury that was going to take me out for another year. And I was depressed about that. And I just went to an army recruiter just downtown, just, and really didn't go downtown specifically to see him. I just happened to be down there, and I walked by an army recruiting office, so I walked in and went through an application, kind of unsolicited on their part, and went through, got the medical and everything a few days, went about a week going through all that and testing and so on. And the recruiter came back and said, "Hey, they'll take, we can get you out of here in about 6 months." And so, well, that's the delayed entry program. And, forget it. I'll just go back to school. And on my way out, the Marine recruiter was right next door to the Army recruiting office. And on my way out the door, there's this guy standing there in his, in a khaki shirt, blue trousers with a red stripe on the side. He's looking sharp, But I'm, I don't know who he is, but because he's, And he says, as I'm leaving, he says, "Hey, are you going to join the army?" And I said, "Nah, I'm going back to school because, it's going to take 6 months, and by that time, it's, school's going to start. It's just getting a summer, as a matter of fact. School's going to start, but I'm not going to hang around just to go there." He says, "Well, can I get your permission to get your paperwork from them?" I said, "Yeah, sure." And so he goes in, gets the paperwork. He says, comes back. He says, "If I can get you out next week, would you go?" I looked at him and said, "Yeah, sure." Just and so literally, I went through all the army screening. He looked at my paperwork and said, "Okay, I was fully qualified, I guess." And so the next Friday, I was on a plane down to San Diego. I never thought about joining the Marine Corps. And the rest is sort of bizarre history.
And when you joined the Marines, did you enlist or did you go in as an officer?
I was enlisted. I enlisted. And I completed my degree on active duty. And the story, that's where when I got there, I wanted to finish my degree. I wasn't really thinking. Once I got in, I was like, "Okay, I don't know if this is such a great idea." And so I wasn't all that happy. I wasn't all that excited about staying in the Marine Corps. I kind of knew once I knew that the quickest way out was just to make it through the boot camp and go through everything and get it done. And now that since I joined the Marine Corps before I had graduated from college, I should have, I always have these things that I should have done go through my head. And so I said, I knew I should have stayed in school. Or at least that's the way I felt then. So I decided that wasn't my number one priority is to get my degree. And I did. But that's where I went through this transition where I was disappointed that my grades weren't as good as I had hoped. Well, gee whiz, come to find out that my grades were the result of my poor study skills. And so I corrected that and graduated, got a commission. Never didn't get, even after I got a commission, the only reason why I got a commission was just because I could. It wasn't because I had long term aspirations to stay in the Marine Corps even then. And did so I did the got the commission every few years. just seemed like something came up. A new job came along.
What type of commands were you working at, and what was your jobs as an officer?
Well, it's interesting because obviously when I got a commission, the first thing I was a platoon commander. And so I was platoon commander in 1-7 as Dragon's platoon at the time as an anti-armor platoon commander. Through a bunch of circumstances, interestingly enough, who my people ahead of me, the one of the a great company commander, who I really my first company commander where I worked for, he was a great guy. He got into an axe. He got promoted. And back then they had augmentation. You were not a regular officer until you got augmented. He got promoted and augmented at the same time. Got promoted to selected to major. And he was a weapons company commander. He got selected to major and augmented pretty much at the same time. So he goes out. This was at Camp Pendleton. He goes out and he goes partying or something. And he had this red Camaro Z28, which was, this thing was, for its, oh, it would be a, right now, it would be a classic. It would be a, I mean, this was the best one they made. Got an accident, just a major accident on I-5. Got out okay. He was okay. But he was they immediately took him out of the command. They put another guy in there. Because there was a big thing about, accidents and drinking and driving and that sort of thing. And so put another guy in. This other guy was just absolutely over his head, which I didn't, you didn't realize it, but he was totally over his head. And so we had a training cycle where it was already planned, so we had to go to Bridgeport for cold weather training. He took us to Bridgeport. We had this overnight hike. We're supposed to spend. We're supposed to hike across through the woods, basically, and then snow on the ground and that sort of thing. We're supposed to get to the other place, but they teach you in winter survival to stop. If you can't make it to your destination, for us to stop about an hour before the sun goes down so you can set up your camp before it got dark. And apparently, he had the idea that we could make it to our destination so we didn't have to camp. And the problem was, he got us lost. And we were in the woods trudging around. So I remember I was, my platoon was all the way back. And we were walking. And I'm looking at my watch, and it's like, oh, okay, it's about an hour before sundown, and we're not where we need to be. So we need to stop. Well, he didn't stop. Now the sun's down and it's too late to stop. And so at that point, we ended up walking, slowly walking all night, literally walking in circles in the woods and up in Bridgeport, California. And the next morning, they sent a rescue party to find us and guide us back in. And they did. And shortly after that, he was transferred to the Marine Corps Marathon, something or other, marathon team or something. So he was gone, never to come back. And so his XO was a guy, which was part of the reason we got lost, who didn't make it through flight school. We call him Fallen Angel. These guys, they'd send them to the infantry, and of course they'd spend all this time in flight school, didn't become a pilot, but they're like a senior, they're a first lieutenant by then, or something pretty. So they're senior to this, to us, and I was second lieutenant. And so he was our XO. He was clueless, sort of. So he took over the company. He gets the company. And our next iteration is going to 29 Palms. So 29 Palms, what they do, we used to do something, basically a live fire exercise. And so they'd send you a scenario and a maps and things like that to prepare. And so they sent all this stuff to us. And this guy, stuff comes in and we're gonna be there in a month. So I said, okay. So I come in after the stuff came in and I said, hey, when are we gonna sit down and start preparing, going through this scenario? He looks at me. He says, I'm going to tell you something I learned a long time ago. I said, what's that? He says, if you wait till the last minute, it only takes a minute. I said, what? I was shocked. Like, if you wait till the last minute, it only takes a minute. Okay, then. So I took the scenario, and my platoon sergeant and I just went through the entire scenario in our little office in the corner of the barracks. We put our little maps, and had a spiral bound notebook for notes, and kind of wrote out how we would address the scenario, and just kind of scripted everything out, and it was our own thing. We didn't expect, nobody was interested. We just did it because, first off, I wanted to do it because I just wanted to practice something. If he wasn't going to do it, at least I could do it on my own, try. We get to 29 Palms. And of course, he actually never did any preparation. And he had a clerk who kind of set up his maps for him, but that was about it. We get there, and I was on the what he considered the night shift. So we get there, and the exercise starts. We got tanks going and artillery shooting and all this kind of stuff. And he was for the battalion, the weapons company commander is the fire support coordinator. So his job is to coordinate the indirect fires with the maneuver. And so everything is kind of going along. And I mean, it's noisy. You got tanks rolling and shooting. You got artillery shooting. You got mortars shooting, and all this noise. It's like, And we're in the, like in an OP kind of area, but we're actually supposed to be controlling all this, at least coordinating it, making sure it's safe. And of course, since I wasn't in the day shift, I was just standing outside the tent basically, and looking in, watching what was going on. Sure enough, all of a sudden, the radio operator says, "Sir," to him, "Sir, we got fast movers coming in. What do you want to do?" And fast movers are jets with live bombs on them. And I looked at him, And I'm standing at the doorway, just kind of like, trying to be, pretty much out of the way. I look at him and his eyes just got big. It's like, oh. And the guy in the radio operator says, he starts yelling at him, "Sir, what are we gonna do? We got fast movers coming in. They got 500 pounders on it." It's like, and he's like, he's not saying anything. And then he did it like a third time, ask him again. And then he just grabbed the radio and says, "Cease fire, cease fire." The radio operator does this. And so all of a sudden, you got all these noise, tanks moving and artillery shooting and fast movers flying in and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, it gets quiet. It's like just like that. It's like all of a sudden, you could hear a cricket. Everybody just stopped, except the airplane. Airplane just, they did an abort. They aborted their mission. And the battalion commander at the time, guy by the name of Smolin, matter of fact, who was a real gentleman, really, he was a quality guy. He stops everything, and he comes in. He on the radio, he says, "Hey, I'm coming up to your position," and I can hear the radio. And so I'm like, "Oh boy, here we go." Driving across the desert takes him, even though he's not that far away. His dirt roads and everything, it takes 20 to 30 minutes for him to get to where we are. He gets there, he takes a fallen angel, takes him, he says, "Hey, I need to talk to you." They walk away, and he's not saying anything. He doesn't say anything to anybody else. And they're about 20, 30 yards away out of sound. Anyway, and then he comes back. He says, "Okay, we're gonna restart this tomorrow. Everybody get some rest, and we're gonna redo this again. Try it again tomorrow." Just like that. That was about it. So I said, "Okay." So he handled it. He didn't. Do it. He didn't humiliate the guy or anything. He just kind of said, "Oh." And that was about it. Well, that night, since I was on the night watch, and we had pretty much shut down the exercise, or at least I thought, I'm on the night watch, and somebody comes up on the radio and says, "Okay, we're going to do a night exercise." I'm like, "What?" It's like, and everybody, the main crew, the first team, if you will, they're all in the sleeping bag. So I said, "Okay." So I pulled, basically, they give us a scenario. It was sort of close to what we had already worked out in our little thing with my platoon sergeant. And so me, my platoon sergeant, and a couple other people that were on the night shift, we ran the drill that they ran, that they set up for us. And it went pretty good. It was sort of like I looked at it like, this is like a consolation prize, it's something for you to do. I didn't think much of it. And the next day, we did a kind of a reduced exercise for the first team. And they did nothing, and everything was sequential. It's like, okay, now shoot some artillery. It's like, okay, now shoot some mortars. Okay, stop. Okay, now shoot some artillery again. Okay, stop. I mean, it was literally like that. And so after that, the next day after that, we go in for what we call the after action. And of course, they do the after action. They talk about the first day and how bad it was. So, we had, it was probably one of the worst exercises. One of the first times we've ever had to stop the exercise because, of basically, for lack of a better way to put it was because we're so inept. He said, but there was one thing that happened good that day, and that was the night exercise. And I'm thinking, oh my God. And then he goes further and says, hey, he says, this was the best, the contrast was we had the best night exercise that we've had here. And I went, and I'm sitting there. Now I really feel like I was really hoping to be about 2 feet tall. I wanted to disappear at that point. Because it's like, I don't want to be I don't want to be the one, who all of a sudden benefits from disaster. And not only that, but I'm not sure what's going on. And eventually the guy said, they talk about how what a great job this night exercise was. He said, well, because we were on radios and we were actually remote, they didn't know who I was. And the briefer says, the person in charge of the night exercise, please stand up. Now I'm like, oh my God. And I literally stood up. I'm a second lieutenant. Just watched the captain and first lieutenants getting smashed. And I'm like in the back, I'm really trying to hide. And literally to add to a little bit more, I'm the only African American in the room also, which made it even more uncomfortable for me. Anyway, says, okay, that you did a great job. And so I said, thank you. And I could just feel everybody's eyes looking at me. So I sat down. And so we had a bus. We were from station at Camp Pendleton, so we had to bus all the way back to Camp Pendleton from 29 Ponds. And I remember getting on the bus. And I just, I didn't even say anything. I just sat down and, closed my eyes, hopefully to fall asleep or at least pretend like I was asleep. Drive all the way back. And next thing you know, a couple days later, I'm walking through the hallway in the battalion, and the battalion commander got Simone asked me, what's your plan for the Marine Corps? You don't want to stay in or what? My plan is just to do the best I can every day. That's it. Take each day as it comes. He says, okay. He says, that's all I really want to hear. So the next, that's the extent, pretty much the extent of our conversation. And next day, he announces that this guy, the fallen angel, if you will, Mr. If it only takes, if you wait till the last minute, it only takes a minute. He's getting transferred. He's gone. And he's gone to some war game somewhere. He's going to work on some war game for the Marine Corps, and it's going to be about a year. He'll be gone. So who's going to take over the company? Oh, well, you are. I was like, oh my goodness. Now I'm a second lieutenant, and now I'm the weapons company commander. And the thing is, I said to myself, I asked him, well, what, why is it you got captains in these other companies? What, one of them, why aren't any of them taking it? I said, Colonel says, hey, nobody else wants it. After, and I guess what it amounted to was two company commanders have already been relieved in this company. So we couldn't, we couldn't get a captain to take it. They were like, "Oh, no, I'm good." And so that's how I ended up being the weapons company commander as a second lieutenant. I did that for the next couple of years. And
Wow, what time frame was that?
oh man, I kind of figured you'd ask me that. That's probably 83, 84, something like that. 80 some, right in there. Because I went from there to Parris Island. So yeah, then maybe 84, 85. I ended up in Parris Island around 86, I believe. So
And I know it would be talking forever if we went through your entire career, but I wanted to focus on a few things, particularly your experience in the Gulf War, and then so we'll do that, and then like 10 years after that, or 12 years, 13 years, then you do the invasion of Iraq, and then yeah. But so, where were you, in the Gulf War, like where were you in your career? What rank were you? Just kind of talk about that a little bit.
at the time I was at as it when the Gulf War started, or before, when that whole situation developed, I was at actually it just arrived in 29 Palms from Parris Island. And how I ended up at Parris Island was when I was at 20 when I was at excuse me when I was at Parris Island. And I had orders go to command and staff. No. Amphibious War College. Excuse me. I wasn't selected for the Amphibious War College. So I was going to have to do it remotely and that sort of thing. So fine. But then my battalion commander that I was leaving said, "Hey, the way careers work nowadays, if you didn't go to if you don't go to AWS, it's pretty unlikely you'll ever get command again." So, oh geez, that's not cool. Because I'm not loving this staff thing. Anyway, but if you're willing to go to 29 Palms and take an LAV company, you have a company right now. This is like, this is like, okay, if you're willing, 29 Palms is the worst place you ever want to be stationed, or at least that's the way it was in the Marine Corps. Because I'd been there before, so it wasn't that bad to me, but. And then taking an LAV company was, they were saying, oh, them, the rumor was if you take an LAV company, that's a kiss of death for your career. Kiss of death. Well, considering the fact that I didn't have a career, it's like, it was like, okay. Yeah, kind of hard to kill something you don't even have. But anyway, that's how I looked at it. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll be in charge, and that's good enough for me. And yeah, whatever. I get there, and LAVs are a new thing, and we're literally there's no we got no manuals for how to operate in the LAVs, how to structure all that kind of stuff, none of it. And we're kind of trying to look through some army manuals on cavalry and armor and trying to figure out what to do. And we get, so we're out there and we're training and I'm at 29 Palms, so we're training between those big exercises that the battalions that come to 29 Palms to do. We're a tenant unit, so we Between the exercises, we can go out and train. And so we're out there, and we're out there basically just, what amounts to almost setting up targets and shooting at them. We're just, it's like, because literally I'm just learning how the vehicles work. Next thing you know, we're notified. I'm literally in the field, and we get a notification that that the Iraq invaded Kuwait, and the United States is mobilizing, and the desert units, the units that are stationed in the desert, are going to go first for the Marine Corps. Like, wow. The only thing I had going for me, that we had for going for ourselves, was we were stationed in the desert. That was about it. We didn't have any kind of TTPs, no tactics, techniques, and procedures, nothing other than just the fact that we're literally learning that vehicle, and we were stationed in Twin Ampol. Obviously, we get there, and that at that point, we're there months early. There's nobody else, literally nobody else on the ground. We get there and get LAVs off of these MPF ships. So we flew in, met the gear, get the stuff off the ships, and we drive out into the desert. And we're about 100 miles from the Kuwait border. Nobody else was out there. And the whole idea was, if the Iraqis move south into Saudi Arabia, we were there as an early warning. And we were they'd call it the speed bump, because they were going to be much more than what we had. And so that's pretty much our mission. We started training.
Hey everyone, this is Matt, just jumping in to say that this concludes part one. Please subscribe so you don't miss part two, which comes out on Thursday, where Eddie discusses his Navy Cross action and so much more. Thanks for listening.